I'm diving straight in today because we are joined by Dr. Vonda Wright, our first guest here on the podcast 5 years ago. And Vonda, I think it's been an incredible journey for women. I don't know whether it's just because of the age and this era that we're in, but it feels like there's so much more conversation in the last 5 years, so much more noise, so much more information. And I feel like women's longevity has taken leaps and bounds because of you and the menopause that are out there that are promoting and screaming and demanding attention. Do you feel like the 5 years since we last spoke has been an incredible transformation? Are you being heard?
I was going to say that you and I spoke for the first time 18 months ago or 2 years ago. I can't believe it's been 5 years. But my perspective is that we may be living in the best time in the history of the world thus far to be a midlife woman. Because what we know, even as more recently as the baby boomers, the women in their 60s to 70s, you know, they're our older sisters, and it wasn't great for them.
No.
And because of this five-year conversation that you and I have both been on, I can honestly say, I feel like I have mastered this. And if we can take what we've learned and the conversations and make it so our millennial girlfriends and our daughters, I have two daughters. I have a 31-year-old and an 18-year-old, and I have three daughters-in-law in their 30s. If we can keep going so that those girls never even know it was an issue, our work will have been done, right?
100%. I've got teenage girls, and to hear them come home from science and biology and they're talking about things that were never discussed about our own bodies is phenomenal. My 15-year-old's doing, you know, an entire term on genes this year. I'm cheering. I'm so excited. And I could actually have a conversation with her about it with some knowledge because, again, in that past, I'm sure our mothers and our fathers perhaps would have just nodded. It wasn't science. It was science fiction back then. But to see it now all coming together in this perfect storm, yes, it was going to take Gen X to do it. And I know all the millennials and the Zs will be, you know, kicking me for that. But we get stuff done. And I feel like we've got a strong voice. I recently, of course, listened to the podcast with Diary of a CEO, Stephen Bartlett, who had yourself, mm-hmm. Mary Claire, Stacey Sims, all mm-hmm. together in the one room, and I was blown away. I thought this would never have happened.
That's right. I think that is the key. That would never have happened. And do you know how long we recorded? It was also Natalie Crawford, who's a fertility doctor. 9 hours we recorded, and I'm not kidding you, we could probably go and do it again and again because there is so much we need to know and discover. But thank goodness we were able to have that discussion in two parts. And, you know, thank goodness 5 years ago you started this discussion because at the time you guys started, it was the baby beginning, right? This movement is not that old.
It's really not. And again, I don't know whether it was just because we came in at that time and that's why we started tuning in. But that's the beautiful thing. Every woman is going to hit this age and now there is information there for them. So if you are a bit younger, if you're in your mid-30s and you're just starting to listen to us now, oh my God, we've got such a great back catalogue for you.
That's right.
If you've been on the journey with us, you're obviously growing and learning and possibly at times have felt a little bit lost and a little bit overwhelmed with the amount of information coming in now. But luckily we have our beautiful guides like Dr. Vonda to steer us through. So now we're wearing the devices, we're doing the exercise, we're eating the right things, we're hopefully sleeping better, we're taking care of ourselves. Mm-hmm. I really want to focus on, I guess, how we now sift through that and find the most important things to narrow down on. Mm-hmm. You know, it is about obviously your main wheelhouse is bone density and bone strength because on the other end you're seeing our frailer generations coming in now, having their hips done, broken bones, and you're actually seeing aging from the inside, and it's not pretty, Vonda.
So all of us probably can think of an aunt or maybe our mothers or our grandmothers who we've seen go from being vibrant like us and year after year, maybe they've become more frail due to no fault of their own other than they were never taught about hormone optimization. My mother's generation of women didn't sweat. It was not common for, you know, and so because of that, they never built muscle. They never built bone. They lived through the time of in the 80s when all the models were heroin chic, if you will. The teenier, the better, right? But what that leads to is in many, many cases, a future of frailty. And what do I mean by that? It means you lose the ability, and it seems silly to say it out loud, but first you lose the ability to open things yourselves, right? You can't make your own food if you can't open a package or a jar and you live alone, right? And then as you become more frail, maybe you lose the ability to walk for long distances, or it becomes a tipping point when you become so frail that you can't get out of a chair. And we call that the frailty line. And when you're like that, or even if you're very functional, you may fall. And if you fall and don't know that your bones are fragile, you may break a hip. 70% of all hip fractures occur in women due to lack of exercise. We are all trying not to eat. And many women who are 70 and above never got hormones. You break your femur, 30% of the time you'll die in the first year due to complications of fracture. Because it's not only just the fracture. Many women I see in the hospital come in with chronic bladder infections, UTIs, because they were never offered vaginal estrogen for the genitourinary syndrome of menopause. Many women who come in for their hip fractures may have unknown heart disease because women and men present differently with their heart disease, and it may have gone unchecked before. And then many women, unfortunately, that I see with hip fractures also have a touch of dementia, either because this current situation is so stressful or because they're one of the 70% of all people with Alzheimer's disease who are women. And so when we talk about losing our ability to be healthy, vital, active, joyful, and how hip fractures can kill people within 1 year, it's the cumulative effect of all the systems. And then if you are able to survive it, 50% of the time, you can't go home to the place you've raised your children or where you're living in community because you're just too frail. And so those are a couple of the staggering numbers and real life situations that I see every day. So when I say start out this conversation by saying, you know, this is probably the best time in the history of the world for women to grow old, it's because it's the first time that we're looking down the road and saying, I am never going to get there. I'm going to start when I'm 30, 40, 50 to use all the tools in the toolbox to stay strong in muscle, to stay strong in bone. But when you talk about that, I do talk a lot about bone. I'm really trying to spread the message throughout the world of the concept of skeletal longevity. And let me talk about what that is. It's not just muscle and bone, although those are two primary. We also lose our ability to move when we get arthritis, which is the loss of cartilage. We have known, get this statistic, we have known for 100 years, 1925 was the first time a paper was published on the arthritis of menopause. Arthritis is why your knees hurt so much that you don't want to move and why you need a knee replacement. 100 years. And we're all scratching our heads about, why is this happening? Well, cartilage has estrogen.
It's been happening.
I mean, why are we still shaking our heads? I'm an orthopod. I'm blaming ourselves, right? Or I get women all the time whose tendons are killing them, their elbows, their feet, their Achilles tendons. So when I talk about skeletal longevity, it is muscle. We need a lot of it. It is bone. We need strong bones, but it's our cartilage, our tendon and ligament, and the tools we use for our whole body work for the skeletal system. And that's important because I hope a light bulb goes off when I say this next. Every single person, me, you, everyone you've ever talked to about this, all the influencers say, exercise is the key to long life. It is the medicine that is good for your brain and your heart. And name of organs, it's exercise, right? But if you step back and think, well, what would prevent me from being able to have access to this very, very critical tool to live long and prosper? Exercise. It's your skeletal longevity. If your knees are so bad you can't walk, if you have no muscle mass, if your bones are so brittle that you're afraid of, go on and on. I can talk all about every tissue, but doesn't that make sense?
It does. And we know it's coming. Okay. You know, you cannot pretend anymore that you are going to be the one that breezes through, that you don't feel like you're getting any older, therefore you're not getting any older. I mean, you can sit here and even doing exercise and lifting heavy and bashing our bones. Yes, you're going to get sore, aren't you? There's no denying that one. We're all going to ache, but it's hopefully a good ache. It's
a good sore.
And there is a difference in that. But I don't think anyone could pretend anymore that they can escape doing exercise. And it's really sad when you can't find joy in exercise. And I think too, that's a line. At first, it's going to be hard and it's going to hurt and you're not going to want to get out of bed, and you will find 1,000 other things to do, even vacuuming under the beds. You will do that so you don't have to exercise. I try and incorporate that into my exercise. I am lifting the bed with one arm. I am scooping the vacuum cleaner under there. That is part of my exercise routine. So it's not necessarily putting my kid on and going to the gym or going for a walk or whatever it might be. You can incorporate all this movement into your everyday.
Mm-hmm. And well, you should, right? You should. We probably talked about this, or I talk about it so often. We need to retrain our balance so we don't fall down and break something. Do that while you're, you know, standing at the kitchen sink on one leg, or brushing your teeth, or at your desk. Throw some of this movement into your life so it doesn't feel like, oh, this 1 hour opportunity a day, it becomes just how you live.
Imagine this, unlocking your genetic blueprint with insights from over 200 healthy aging genes, pinpointing your unique SNPs and potential red flags, understanding what your body needs to thrive and where it may need some extra support. No more guesswork, no more random supplements, one-off blood tests, or one-size-fits-all advice. For the first time in history, we have access to the power of genetic testing, something no generation before us has had. This information could change everything. Join our free DNA webinar and you'll get our Stay Well scorecard jam-packed with the markers that we want you to track every year, starting now. Friends, know your genes, own your health. Let's learn to thrive together. Visit theagingproject.com to register, and I'll see you there. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're aiming for. And today we're going to also talk a lot about numbers now. Some of us are wearing the devices, whether it be the Whoops or the bands, and we can now see all these figures coming through and the little graphs and things.
Yeah.
What are we actually looking for? What is optimal? Is that different for every woman, or are these targets that we're heading for?
Do you want to talk about specific biomarkers like VO2 max or?
Let's start with VO2 max. Absolutely. What is it?
Then let's hit the blood glucose too. VO2 max is the ultimate measure of fitness. It is a measure of how much oxygen is diffused across the blood from the heart to the lungs to your body. It's an ultimate measure of fitness. It has to do with heart rate, something called stroke volume, how strong your heart is. And it's calculated according to what you weigh and per minute. That's all the technical stuff. Here is the way we use it for prevention. We know that your VO2 max, which is the energy you have, which is your fitness, will decline 10% per decade if you do not work on it. If you're not moving, if you're not challenging yourself, if you're just slowly walking, enjoying the butterflies, but not challenging yourself moving, 10% per decade. Now, why is that important? Remember, we were talking about frailty and not getting up from a chair, not being able to take care of yourself. Well, that's called a frailty line. The frailty line is an actual VO2 max value. 16 is the value for women. 18 is the value for men. When you cross the frailty line with your VO2 max, you can't get up from a chair. You don't have the physical fitness to get up from a chair. And it forces some really hard decisions. So how do we use that? If we know we never want to cross the frailty line, then if we look at our VO2 max in midlife, whether we do it on our WHOOP or whether we actually have a VO2 max test done where they put a mask on you and you are on a bike or a treadmill, we want our midlife VO2 max to be great. You know, 50 would be considered excellent for a woman. 35 is considered fine. But let's do the math, right? If you have a VO2 max of, let's just say 35 when you're 50, mm-hmm. Well, by the time you're 60, if you do nothing, that will drop to 40 something. What did I say? 35. That'll drop to 30. 70, you'll be in your mid-20s. 80, you'll be about 20. And you can mm-hmm. see that it becomes very dangerously close to the frailty line. The good news is you can build your fitness, right? You are not destined to just go downhill. So if in midlife we start working really hard, we train our cardiovascular fitness, we don't have to drop 10% and we can even build our VO2 max. So that's how we use that number to see where we are now, knowing that we never want to cross the frailty line. And so how do you build VO2 max? Well, cardiovascular exercise and not just slow walking. We have to challenge ourselves. There's an actual method called the Norwegian protocol, which is necessary, but not necessarily pleasure until you're done. So what the Norwegian protocol is whatever apparatus you want, you go as hard as you can for 4 minutes, like everything's out there. You're not leaving any energy left. And when you're done with 4 minutes, you recover for 4 minutes. And then after 4 minutes, you just go again. And you do 4 minutes, 4 minutes of rest, 4 repetitions. Now, the good news is you only have to do it once a week. It's that stimulating to your body. But that mm-hmm. is a way to ensure your future is less frail than it could be.
Okay. So what does your Norwegian protocol look like now? What do you do for your hardcore 4 minutes? Yeah. What is it that you do?
So my cardio regimen is, and in my book, Unbreakable, I talk about how we do this. I spend most of my time at base training. So at my lactate threshold, which I've done it by running and having my finger pricked, but you can do it by estimating 181 minus your age. That's the heart rate that I spend most of my time at. So for me, it's about 130. And so 45 minutes at a time, I use a treadmill and I'm training for an altitude race. So I hike up the incline to about 15 and I'm walking at about 3. And that keeps my heart rate because of the incline. Twice a week, I do sprint intervals, which means All it means is I put the...
You're not sprinting for 4 minutes, surely.
Well, no, they're
different. You're like running the magic mile.
I'm giving you the full cardios that I do every week. Mm-hmm. I spend 80% of my time at base training, 20%, 2 days a week. After base training, I sprint my guts out. I just get my heart rate as hard as I can for 30 seconds with complete recovery. And then I repeat that 4 times, right? Mm-hmm. But then 1 day a week is Norwegian protocol day, usually Mondays, because it's just get the thing over
just
with.
Just get it over with.
And I still do it on a treadmill. I don't like bikes at all. So I'm going 4 minutes as hard as I can go. It's not as fast as my regular sprinting because it's 4 minutes, not 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. But I only get 4 minutes to recover. So I know it sounds confusing to hear it, but it's actually not. We're doing most days 45 minutes at a low heart rate. 2 days, you're going to go as fast as you can. And then 1 day a week, we're going to really work on our VO2 max, which is the Norwegian protocol. 4 minutes on, as fast as you can go. 4 minutes recovery, repeat it 4 times. You will be amazed how quickly you feel differently when you actually challenge your body, right? Our bodies, no matter what our age, are made to adapt. And so sometimes we underestimate our capacity. And so I just encourage people listening, if you haven't tried to push your body, you will love what you're capable of.
Over at You Must Try It, we've discovered so many fabulous low-tox skin and makeup options. Many of our guests have spoken about reducing our overall toxic load, so that has become a huge priority for me. I've slowly moved to low-tox products, and You Must Try It have made it really easy. We only stock low-tox products we've tried, tested, and love at youmusttryit.com. So we have done the research for you. If you haven't visited us already, please stop by at youmusttryit.com for 10% off your first order. This is, of course, and as you say, it's written there in your book, which only came out in, what, August. Last year?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Unbreakable. It really is a Bible for women to age well and to find that power. And you've got it all written in there, and it is fabulous. And you just describe, I guess, if you're thinking of your heart and your lungs, particularly blood and muscles on top of that, as your engine, as your aerobic engine.
Yeah.
And as you say, yes, to be breathless from exercise.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary feeling if you haven't had it for a while.
Well, and what a privilege to be able to do that with exercise and not just walking from your car to your front door, right? Mm. Yeah. Yes. So That's a beautiful thing to work towards.
I love the idea of obviously your base training and this incline because, yes, walking on the flat, it takes some effort to get your heart rate up. But you put that incline up just a couple of points and it's amazing what difference that actually makes. And you can feel your engine working.
Yeah. Yeah, completely, completely.
So VO2 max is one thing.
Yeah.
Then there's your heart rate variability. Now, what is that and what does that mean for overall wellness?
Heart rate variability, we think of our heart rate as a steady cadence, blah, blah, blah. And it is. But in a healthy situation, your heart rate comes at a slightly different time every beat set. And so heart rate variability can be a good measure of not only overall fitness, but mostly recovery. How well did you sleep? How autonomically your autonomic nervous system, how regulated is that? How stressed are you? Are you recovered enough to work hard again the next day? And so when we see altered heart rate variability, it may mean that you're not sleeping as well as you think you are, or that you're not recovered enough, or that you didn't hydrate enough. But there is some debate, and I am not an expert on this, but there is some debate that on many of the wearables that the algorithms favor men's physiology. I mean, Stacey.
Surprise.
Yeah. Stacey Sims talks about this a lot and how while it's useful, I don't think mere mortal women like me. I'm a mere mortal athlete. I am athletic. I do races, but I'm not on a podium. I'm not training as an elite athlete. I think for us, it's interesting information, but not something to obsess about.
Good. Okay. Good to know.
Yeah. Yes.
Whereas your resting heart rate is important, isn't it?
It is important. And it predicts longevity, right? We want a resting heart rate 60, 70. We don't want our resting heart rate chugging along at 80, 90 above, right? It just indicates how hard we're working just for basal metabolic rate, right? And the better shape you are, the better your VO2 max, the lower your heart rate will be. That's why people who grew up as endurance athletes have such low heart rates. For instance, I'll give you two examples. They're both men, actually, unfortunately. But my father, who's 86, was an endurance athlete my whole life. He ran long races. He's 86. His resting heart rate is still in the 50s. And every time we go to the doctor, we have to tell them this is his resting heart rate. He's not having a beta branch problem or whatever it's called. And then my own husband, who is a professional athlete, a professional hockey player, he's 62 now. His resting heart rate, despite not being in the kind of shape he was when he was a young pro athlete, is in the low 50s, almost 40 sometimes. So what that tells us, though, for the younger listeners or those of us who have younger children, what we do as in our youth in terms of fitness and mitochondrial load. Mitochondria are the powerhouses of our cells. And we lay a lot of that down when we're in our youth. That's really critical. And that's why can not letting there be these, if we can possibly, huge gaps in our fitness, right? Where maybe we ran around in high school, maybe at university, and then we take 15, 20 years off to do our careers and our children. It would be amazing to just continue our lifestyle through the critical decade of 35 to 45 and then into peri, and then so that when the time we reach menopause and beyond, we're not in this mad catch-up phase, right? Doesn't that seem like an easier task just to stick with it?
But we didn't, did we? So that is why we are here. But our children will. Hopefully our children will.
Yeah.
And I'm going to digress a little bit here because one of the stats I've heard you talk about recently is the amount of bone density that you lose during breastfeeding. Now, I had no idea about that. I breastfed, you know, two girls. But if you had three children or four children, that could be, you know, 6 years of breastfeeding. Yeah. And you're losing bone density the whole way through. So you do have to keep up your exercise and your protocols, even when you have little kids. So you're then not playing catch up at the end. And that shocked the hell out of me, to be honest, because I thought, have I even made that up again yet?
Well, it's a good question. And if you don't mind, I'm going to go back a few years and talk about bone across the lifespan, because we've got all ages of women here. So in our adolescence, you know, once we hit puberty, we come into our hormones, we reach peak bone and muscle density in our late 20s. By the time we're 30, we've reached peak. And so there are many women, and I get DEXA scans, and now I'm getting REMS ultrasounds to look at bone quality on every woman who comes to my orthopedic clinic. And I find very young women with osteopenia, which is poor bone density. And why could that be? They're young women. Well, number one, I have some hypotheses. Why aren't young women building enough bone that I see? Well, number one, maybe they have been such high-level athletes in their youth that they didn't have periods, right? I was like that. I was such an active person, I was a dancer and a runner, such low body fat. For 6 or 9 months, I wouldn't have a period when I was a teenager and in college. And I'm like, yes, because, you know, it was inconvenient. I'm like, yes, I'm not having it. But what I didn't know is that I wasn't building bone. Thank goodness my bone is fine right now, but it could have been very bad. So one, we didn't build enough. Number two, I think we're back. I hoped we were out of it, and I don't know that we are. Girls are still taught that they have to be this skinny, and therefore they don't eat. right? And without enough nutrition, you're not going to build enough bone. And number three, when you're young, maybe you're not active. Maybe you are eating. Maybe you're just too sedentary and we're not bashing our bones. But either way, I see lots of young women who really need to work on their bone density, because then exactly to your point, when we're pregnant, our body will protect the baby. It takes about 500 to 1,000 milligrams of calcium a day to build this little person. Now, hopefully we're eating enough calcium in our food. But if we're not, for any reason, our bodies will use ourselves. This is nature's way. We know this is going to happen. So I'm not saying it's a disease or abnormal, but there is an entity called the osteoporosis of pregnancy, which can result in mostly spine fractures. Mm-hmm. Imagine carrying around a new baby with a spine fracture. The good news is, before we all get a lot of hate mail, the body knows we lose bone. And as long as we feed our body, you will rebuild that bone, because we're going to restore the mother. But then many of us choose to breastfeed. I breastfed my daughter, and for a year I would have done it longer, but she was done with that. And we must replace the calcium that we use to build milk. Again, it's about 500 milligrams a day. If we are replacing it with our food, our bones will rebuild. But if we're like so typical mothers, we're exhausted, we're barely latching on, maybe we're drinking water because we know we have to, but maybe we're not eating enough, or, you know, some babies are intolerant of some of the foods, dairy that the mother is eating. So if there's a lot of reasons, we can get in deficit. And then to your point, if you have your children in close succession, we have to be careful to see what our bones are doing, because what happens next? Perimenopause. In perimenopause, when estrogen walks out the door and doesn't even look back, you can lose 20% of your bone density. So if we didn't build it when we were an adolescent, if we lost more when we were a mother, we're entering perimenopause even more vulnerable. And I don't say any of this, my friend, to fearmonger. Sometimes I'm accused on the internet of fearmongering. If I didn't tell you this, I would be lying to you. I'm not fearmongering. I am telling you the truth, because we talked about it earlier. I am a practicing orthopedic surgeon. This is not theoretical to me. This is not me reading somebody else's book or somebody else's research. This is every time I take care of a woman with a fracture. Her bones have failed her, and she didn't even know until she fractured. So I say this not to be doom and gloom, but so you know, and so you know that we can prevent this bone loss, this muscle loss, by starting earlier, by being aware. So what if you're a perimenopausal woman and you're like, oh my God, she just said I'm going to lose 20% of my bone density, right? What am I going to do? Well, you're going to make your hormone optimization decision. You're going to decide whether estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone are right for you. I believe every woman gets to choose, but I'm going to tell you, your bones love those for building, number one. Number two, bones need for you to jump around on them. We need to generate 4 times body weight, either every day with 20 to 50 jumps, or 3 times a week. You can do a concentrated 10 minutes of jumping in multiple directions. Our bones need that to build. We need to lift weights. The 3 most powerful ways to build bone are hormone optimization, impact exercise, and lifting weights. Oh, and you got to feed yourself, ladies. Bones are 50% protein. We have to feed ourselves. If you are in perimenopause, that is your recipe right there.
And again, there is no denying it. There is no ignoring it. There is no skipping it. There is no saying it won't happen to me, because it will. It will happen to each and every one of us. And you have the choice. And it's not really even a choice, is it? You have to do it, or
by not making a choice to do it, you're making a choice by default to expose yourself to frailty. So even for the women out there who aren't bothered by their night sweats, hot flashes, maybe they've gotten away with something. They're just not suffering like so many women do. I contend to them that you don't feel your bones. You cannot perceive your loss of muscle mass, right? So you may not have the typical things, night sweats, brain fog, hot flashes.
Goes on and on and on and on and on.
Maybe you're getting away with that, but you cannot feel the rest of it, your brain, your heart, your bones.
So a DEXA scan is one way to measure your bone density. Yeah. That's another number that we need to really take into account.
Yes. So DEXA scans use X-ray to measure a lot of things, actually. I think even if your doctor doesn't offer you one, you should really question your doctor about it, because we'll start with bone and then I'll tell you what else you can find from your DEXA scan. Your DEXA scan will tell you the mineralization of your bones, how hard your bones are. It will give you a number called a T-score, which compares your bones to the bones of a healthy 30-year-old woman. So any positive number you get as a T score means that your bones are better than a 30-year-old woman. Any number from 0 to -1 is still considered normal, but -1 T score means you are osteopenic, meaning you have the beginnings of weak bones. This, my friends, is, if it's the first wake-up call, this is the wake-up call. Your body is now telling you, my bones are suffering, and you need to get on those four things that I talked about: the hormone optimization, jumping around, building muscle, and feeding your bones. If your T score reaches -2.5, that is the diagnosis of osteoporosis, which is where we see 1 in 2 women with osteoporosis will have a fracture in their lifetime. So it's either, if it's you or me, my friend, when we, it's like that two girlfriends in a room, one of us is going to have a major fracture. So it becomes a call to action, not just an observation. It's a, what am I going to do now to save my bones? So that is the bone information you can get from a DEXA scan. But the amazing thing is, when done correctly, the DEXA scan will tell you what your body fat is. Not only the body fat hanging off in inconvenient places, the percentage of body fat, it'll tell you how much of your body fat is called visceral fat. That's the fat that is smothering your internal organs, and that is the dangerous fat that causes insulin insensitivity, poor glucose metabolism, high inflammation. DEXA scan will give you those numbers. It will also tell you how much muscle you have. It will tell you something called the basal metabolic rate, which is how many calories that you burn just sitting here like this. That number, basal metabolic rate, is dependent on how much muscle mass you have.
So this is, I mean, again, this is something that you should just have done, whether it's with your bloods and you're getting your baseline. Of course, we're very pro-genetic testing here with Fit Genes. Just get your baselines, know as much about your own body as possible, so then you can make the next decisions. But if you find that you're in that osteopenia, osteoporosis, you can reverse that by doing your protocols.
Yeah.
Bone bashing. Yeah. The hormone replacement, obviously eating well, exercise, weightlifting, that can actually reverse osteoporosis.
Yeah. So two things. Number one, in Australia, in the United States, insurance will not pay for a DEXA scan until you're 65. In Australia, it will not pay for it until you're 70. I'm just going to say to you, my ladies, scrape your coffee money together and please go pay for it yourself, and do it, I would suggest, as early as 40. Just find out the status of your bones before you hit perimenopause or any time along the journey. Do not accept the 70-year-old because by then you've already lost your bone and you are subject to fracture. So that's number one. Number two, what's interesting is some of the best data in the world about whether or not you can rebuild bone after you're osteoporotic comes from New Zealand, where a researcher named Belinda Beck did a study called the Liftmore study, where she took women with frank osteoporosis, meaning T-scores of minus 2.5, and under supervision, put them through a protocol that was heavy lifting, meaning so heavy, these women could only lift a weight five times. Heavy lifting plus jumping. And she showed that not only can you safely do it without breaking with supervision, but that you could stabilize and build bone density. So it's a message of hope, not a destiny of frailty.
Yes. But if you don't know, you don't know, do you? Until you say, you're saying, you don't hear your bones until they break. Right. They do not speak to you like muscles do, like aches and pains do. Your bones don't speak until it's too late.
Yeah, right.
It's fascinating, as you say, and of course we suggest do all of this with your physician, under guidance, with professional help to get this all back on track. But it's never too late, Vonda.
Never. Not one bit. There are popping up all over the internet now these amazing stories about women who are really starting in their 70s and 80s and barely able to walk. And over a very short amount of time, they're getting stronger with better posture. And there is never an age or skill level when it's just too late for you. It will always be too late for you, however, if you never start.
A great place to start is, again, with one of the tests that you have in your book that gives us a little protocol of what to do. The push-ups one, I will be honest, brought me unstuck. This is my weakness. I don't know what it is. I was a horse rider as a child, so I thought I had good upper body strength. No. That was my falling down. And I know now I have some work to do there.
You know what you have as a horse rider is really strong legs to grip the pony and a core, right?
Okay, all the horse riders out there are going, yes, gentle hands. You shouldn't have been pulling too hard on the reins anyway. But hopeless.
So the push-up test, interestingly, became a global phenomenon when I was on a podcast and I just quoted what the American College of Sports Medicine says, and that's that every woman around 50 years old should be able to do 11 push-ups because it's a real measure of total upper body strength, core strength, and it's really about safety, right? Can you get up and down? Can you get out of situations? Can you put things on a shelf? So, oh my gosh, I don't know how many women worldwide. We stopped counting at 55,000. Separate posts trying to do the push-up challenge. And you know what? What it was not a judgment. It was an opportunity to see where you are. It's like the DEXA scan. You'll never know where you are unless you try it. So I thought it was a great thing. It was like this activity that united women of the world because it was from everywhere, not just the U.S. that did the 100%. Challenge. Yeah.
If you are going to do this, if you are thinking of getting down on the floor now and doing push-ups, it has to be on your toes. This is not a knee option. Well, please do it with supervision. Please have somebody standing behind to help you when it all goes bad.
Listen, if you're literally just starting out, start by pushing against a wall. Find a wall and just stand there, right? And then when that's easy, use the back of your couch so you're more horizontal. And when that's easy, go to the floor, but you can put your knees down, right? When that's easy, you're going to be able to do a real push-up.
This time next year, everybody listening, give yourself 12 months to be able to do 11 full
full push-ups.
Full-scale military push-ups.
We'll circle back, ladies.
We will. Why don't we start with the sit-to-rise test? That might be a softer option. And again, this is a great number to be aware of.
Yeah, the sit-to-rise test is just what it sounds like. You're starting in a standing up position. The goal is to sit down without using your hands or putting your knees on the ground. And then once you're down there, the goal is to using your core and your leg and your butt strength to get up, right? And so with each assistance, meaning I put my knee down to sit down, or I put my hand down to sit down, a point is taken away. So there's 10 total points possible, 5 going down, 5 coming up. Now, what is the point of a silly test like this, the sit to rise test? We must be able to get off the ground as we age. We must be able to rescue ourselves, because theoretically, no one's coming to save you, ladies. You have to be self-sufficient, even though probably if you're on the ground, you could find somebody to help you. But that's all it is. Can you sit down without using your knees or your hands? Can you stand up? And if you cannot, you can train. This is a trainable skill. And it is not a judgment. It is an observation of an opportunity to get strong enough not to be frail.
I'm going to put a disclaimer in here and say that the first couple of times you try it, your brain and your body will not connect. So give yourself a break, let your brain figure it out, and then try it again.
You know what? That is a really good reminder, because sometimes when we go to the gym for the first time or do any exercise for the first time, it feels disorienting. And it's exactly what you're saying. It's not because your muscles aren't capable. Is you have not had to use that neuromuscular pathway for a while. The pathway between your brain saying, pick up the weight and curl it, to your muscle to actually execute that. And so I don't want you for 1 minute to think you can't or you're no good at it, because I promise you, the more reps you do, you'll rebuild that neuromuscular pathway and you'll make gains very quickly and feel more coordinated.
And it can be fun. It can be fun. Do it with your kids. Yeah. Do it with your partner. Do it with your friends. Do it down at the park. Give yourself plenty of space with no furniture around you and a soft landing. That's my advice.
Yeah.
Now, this isn't particularly a number, Vonda, but it is something that is going to affect all of us. That's inflammation inflammaging, as we say. And as you're starting to do more and more exercise, as we're now starting to get our VO2 max into place, there are going to be those days where you just feel sore all over. Mm-hmm. And again, through our genetic testing, we realize that some of us are more prone to inflammation than others. So that might be something that you have to take into account. But what is inflammation when it's around the body? It's not just, I've got tennis elbow, you know, and that is obviously a big one. Frozen shoulder, we talk about a lot with women in perimenopause and menopause, but this all over sort of inflammation throughout our body that also holds a lot of physical weight, not just emotional weight, but the physical weight that comes with inflammation in our bodies.
Well, first, I want people to remember that inflammation is actually a normal process our body uses to heal itself. For instance, if you trip off the curb and you sprain your ankle, it's going to get hot, it's going to get swollen, it's going to get stiff, and you're going to have pain. Those are all the things you feel as the body is flooding the area with blood, with the growth factors you need to set up the healing process. Inflammation is normal. What is not normal is when inflammation becomes chronic, meaning you're not hurt anymore, but it just all that cytokine release and pain continues. So why do women in midlife get a lot of inflammation? Well, the reality is that estrogen is a potent anti-inflammatory. And without it, our inflammation rises from a baseline to high. So that's why many women in perimenopause will have some of the musculoskeletal symptoms of menopause, which we described in a paper last year by the same title. But it's things like arthralgia, meaning total body pain. You didn't do anything, you didn't get hurt, but all of a sudden you're stiff and achy and can barely get out of bed. And I had that for no reason. My whole body hurt. Or you just mentioned frozen shoulder. Frozen shoulder is completely what it sounds like. You cannot raise, you're out of nowhere, no injury. Your shoulder hurts, and then you rapidly lose motion. I call it the I can't hook my own bra test because you can't get your arm back there. So that is due to the inflammation of losing estrogen. So the other reason, there are many reasons that you can become inflamed. One is being pre-diabetic or diabetic. Sugar is highly inflammatory. So if you notice the day after you go to a birthday party and binge the huge piece of chocolate cake that you're more stiff and painful, that is the effect of high glucose in our blood, actually. It's a known inflammatory. So if you want to be less inflamed, consider your hormone optimization and stop eating sugar, please. And get your carbs as complex carbs. But the way you were just mentioning is when we exercise, it is normal to have some soreness if we've worked hard enough. If you are not sore the next day, maybe it's time to amp up what you're doing a little bit. But normal post-exercise soreness is gone in a day or two. It probably is a little bit on day one, a little bit more on day two, but by day three, you're ready to go again, right? Mm-hmm. If it persists day four, day five, then either maybe you hurt yourself or you're just not ready to go again. We need to be recovered before we go hard again. So those are very common reasons to have pain and inflammation.
And you're going to see that, again, if we go back to the device, whatever that be, whether it's a Whoop band or something else tracking, do you just have to go on pure feel, or is there a number or a figure back to our heart rate variability or our resting heart rate? Is there going to be an indicator of how much recovery each person actually needs?
Well, both of those measures, baseline, resting heart rate variability. But you know what? Another measure we use in pro athletes is we have them start listening to their own bodies. Every morning when they come to the field or come to the locker room, we have them rate their perceived recovery. Because what that does is that forces them to listen. How do I feel? Is my body heavy? Do I feel a little sluggish? Do I feel slow? And once you start listening, the reps of listening to your body, our athletes start knowing pretty well how recovered they are. Isn't that interesting?
It is, and I love when Stacey talks about this, particularly with young female athletes still have their cycle, that, you know, their coaches are now starting to track their cycles because there's different exercises you should be or could be doing at different times to optimize your training.
Right, depending on where in the phase you are and because you have different estrogen levels. Something not to forget, and especially in a continent like Australia and of course, New Zealand, where there's so much sunshine all the time and hot, when you are dehydrated and haven't restored enough hydration, you will not be recovered, not in brain and not in body, right? So how do you know if you're rehydrated enough to do another heavy workout? Well, one way to track is there's the very intense way, and then there's the, so if you know what your weight is when you go to bed and you do it in the morning, most of us will lose 2 to 3 pounds just in breathing overnight. So that's why the advice of first thing in the morning, you're going to drink water, not coffee, right? Just to restore your hydration. But we do the same thing with our athletes. For instance, if I send a bunch of athletes out on the pitch and they're sweating it off for 3 hours, they can lose 5 to 10 pounds or kilograms in a single workout. They will not be completely recovered unless they replace all that fluid by the next practice. And we actually weigh people at the end of practice and before the next practice so they can gauge for every, I don't know what it is in kilograms, but every pound lost, it's one bottle of water to replace it, right? We can do that with ourselves. Now, you and I are probably not going to lose 5 kilograms of water in a single workout, but we could probably lose on a hot day, 1-2 pounds of water. We could probably lose that on a hot day. We have to replenish that to be completely recovered, or else we're starting out in deficit. Or even, you know, you're working all day, you're not getting up, you don't have enough water at your desk, and then you go try to work out, you may be 10 to 20% dehydrated, which affects your recovery.
So that's it. You've got to start the day, and we do encourage that, with a glass of water, a pinch of salt, a squeeze of lemon, whatever it might be, before you have your coffee, before you even have your protein coffee or your protein shake. Just get up and drink a glass of water. And that way you've at least started well. And I always say that, let's just start every day. We have the opportunity every day to start again and to put all of this into practice and to say, I know I didn't walk yesterday. I know I didn't lift yesterday, but I can today.
Yeah, exactly right.
Leave us with something, Vonda. I mean, we've obviously got so much wonderful information from you for this chat, but if there is one thing that women could do tomorrow morning, or even straight after listening to this, it's you can start at any time during the day, can't you? It's not just a morning thing. You go, right, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. There's still something I can do today to be better tomorrow.
Absolutely. So if you find yourself having skipped a lot of days or never investing in your mobility at all, you've heard us say it's never too late. What I want you to do is start a streak. Have you ever heard of a streak? I want you to start an exercise streak, meaning every day for the next 7 days, just go out and take a brisk walk after your biggest meal. This is if you're just starting out. Every day, push back from your biggest meal and go take a 20-minute walk every single day. What that is going to do after your meal, it's going to push all the glucose into your muscles and lower your blood sugar, which is going to clear your brain. The walk itself will add more blood to your brain, and you're going to feel good when you come back. When you do this 7 days in a row in running and exercise circles, we call it a streak. And after you've been doing it 7 days in a row, you don't want not to do it on the 8th day because you've already done it. And so that is a fantastic way to turn a short-term promise to yourself into a lifetime of self-care.
That is wonderful. That is the only number we actually have to worry about for the next 7 days. Let's get day one done and then day two. Okay, so this is the number, 7 day streak. Please join us on this one. Let's start this right now. Today, 20 minutes, up you get, out you go. And then I want you to come back and I need you to follow Dr. Vonda Wright on Instagram. She is a wealth of information and it's so digestible and so much fun to follow her. Excuse me, to follow her. Her book, Unbreakable, hit the shelves late last year. So if you haven't got hold of that, it is Unbreakable, A Woman's Guide to Aging with Power. Even the title is inspiring. And of course, Doctor has her own podcast, The Dr. Vonda Show. So make sure you jump onto that one. Oh, I love you. Thank you. Thank you so much for being back here on The Aging Project. We cannot wait to speak to you again. Hopefully, it's not 5 years between drinks.
Hopefully not. See you soon.
As always, the Aging Project podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes. Always seek medical advice from a qualified practitioner.